These 40 parables are the oldest form of Jesus' teaching. In other words, if we can hear the parables without the crust of the centuries upon them, then we have a better chance of standing closer to Jesus and to hear what he has to say. We also said that if Jesus was remembered for nothing else, he'd be remembered for inventing the parabolic storytelling style. 150 years after Jesus, that style was adapted by the rabbis and then also by the church. We also said that the work of the archaeologist and others who dig around in Palestine help us to understand the parables, because the setting for the parables is always from the daily life of Palestine. The bread baking, the farming methods, the this, the that, the normal nitty-gritty way in which the people lived informs the parables. Jesus takes that daily round of life and turns them into stories. And so as the more we understand about the daily life, the better chance we have of understanding the parables. We also said that starting very soon after Jesus gave the parables, in other words, around the year 60 or so, allegorical interpretation was the dominant theme, the dominant way to do parables, and that really has dominated the whole church up until the 20th century. The reason for allegorical interpretation were many. One of them was that when the church moved west into the Greek world, Greeks were high on myth, and they paid pastors or whoever to interpret the myths to them, and consequently it was not surprising that the parables were understood mythologically, allegorically, that each little part of the parable was representative of some bigger thing. We use the example of, what do we use? They cast their nets upon the sea. Casting is really what Jesus was really talking about, was preaching, but he was just being tricky about it. Okay. So through the century, allegory has dominated the interpretation style. Also, that happened because of Mark 4:11, where it says, and Jesus spoke to them in parables so that they would not understand. Better it is to translate makhla, not parable, but riddle. He spoke to them, and everything appeared to them to be a riddle. They were confused by the kingdom announcements that he was giving. Adolf Ulliker in the year 1900 came along and did a history of parabolic interpretation, looked back through 19 centuries of that, and was sickened, he said, by what he saw and the ways in which parables were misused by the church. And he said, if they mean anything at any time to anybody, then they mean nothing. Rather, they should mean something specific. And what he concluded was that the parables were general maxims about religion, the kind of thing you'll find in scouting manuals. Be good, be nice, be thrifty, etc. General maxims. And so Ulliker saw Jesus as the apostle of progress. If we will but put those general maxims on 3x5 of the pieces of paper and put them up on our bulletin board or next to our mirror and memorize things like be nice or whatever, then we will all get better and so will the whole world. And Jesus then is the apostle of our progress and the progress of the world. C.H. Dodd came along and said Ulliker was right on part one and wrong on part two. He was wrong in saying that the parables are not our general religious truisms. They're not. Rather, they are announcements of the kingdom. They are defenses of the king, defenses of the gospel, spoken in conflict situations, in specific concrete conflict situations, for the purpose of winning over the critic into the kingdom. And so C.H. Dodd and then Joachim Jeremias come along and take us back to try to find the original meaning of these things. We also talked a little bit about the fact that the early church had to shift these parables around and change them for lots of different reasons. We looked at a few. Some of the parable will say one thing in Mark, it'll say something completely different in Matthew or Luke. We're going to look at one parable today that has in one gospel it means this, in the other gospel it means that. The content of the parable is exactly the same, but the situation in which it's spoken is completely different. Now, why? The reason is because the early church needed to use the parables of Jesus for their own purposes, just like we do. So maybe us changing them around to mean whatever we need them to mean isn't all that bad. At least there's a precedent for it in Matthew and Mark and Luke. There are a lot of other reasons why the parables through the in just the first few years of the church were changed. One of the reasons is that Jesus didn't come back, and they all thought he was going to come back, and he didn't show up. So some of the parables, they switched around so as to explain where was Jesus. Some of the parables became preaching parables. Some of them became ways in which the leadership of the early church was admonished. You know, be a good leader, da-da-da. You'll be held accountable for your leadership in the church. Okay, and that's what the parable meant. Well, Dodd and Jeremiah say that's not at all what the parable meant originally. Originally it meant this. All right. So, what I'm suggesting here is that in addition to looking at parables, what we're doing is we're looking at more than the 40 parables of Jesus. We are looking at parables and parabolic action and simile. Parable, you understand. A short little story, sometimes two or three lines, sometimes long. Parabolic actions are something else again. You remember what similes are. Similes are one-liners. You don't put new wine in old wineskins. Henny Youngman one-liners. Okay. And Jesus used for the announcement of the gospel itself. Jesus used, at least Jeremiah says, he can find out of the 40 parables only one of them that truly is a gospel proclamation. The other 39 parables are all explanations of and defenses of the gospel. So the gospel is set forward in one parable, he says, and, much more importantly, in many, many similes and in many parabolic actions. The similes, you recall, are wine, new wine in old wineskins, new cloth on old cloth, it's harvest time, it's wedding time, it's, what were the rest?
Jubilee
year, now is the lame see, the deaf hear, the blind, the lame see, the blind see, you know. Okay, so through those many, many similes, the announcement of the year of Jubilee is back, and Jesus is saying, here it is. In addition to the similes, there were many parabolic actions, and I don't have them written out, but I'll read just a few of them. Parabolic actions are having a potluck for bad people, okay? Having lunch with sinners. That was a parabolic action. Another one, inviting them into his house was a parabolic action. Inviting them into the circle of his disciples was a parabolic action. Having a feast for tax collectors was a parabolic action. The Eucharist was the common meal that they did was a parabolic action. Healing people, rejecting fasting, giving new names to disciples like Peter, cleansing the temple, riding on a donkey, setting children in the midst of the group, washing feet, da-da-da. Follow all those? That's the drama we're talking about this winter. Okay? Jesus used drama more than he used words. We by the action, like the Eucharist, which was a drama that he staged, and also by the drama of simile. Okay? So maybe the most effective way of communicating gospel, if we at least Jesus thought the most effective way, was not talking about it at all, but staging it. Yes, Charles says.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah, that's true. That's what he did. So he stages the gospel, but now everybody gets mad, or a lot of people get mad. And one way we understand the parables is by understanding who got mad. Now, what we've looked at, first of all, we started over here, and we have said that the religious people were critical. That is, the priests and Levites and all of those employed in the temple, etc., pastors and such. And so they get mad. Jesus responds with nine parables under a general topic called God's mercy for sinners. And we looked at one or two of those. And this is a loving hook. Help me draw it better when we're done or now. Okay. The critics come on and then they respond in that way. Now, in addition to religious critics, in other words, the pious critics here, there were also apostolic critics. In other words, some of the early church said, Jesus, this is a dumb idea. I mean, it's kind of fun now and then, but this is really failing badly, don't you know? And so they were critics of what he was doing also. Jesus responds to their criticism with six Parables of Assurance. We're going to start with that today. So the critics were not just outside of the church, they were inside the church too.
Were those the actual apostles, the disciples that Jesus talked to with these parables?
The 12.
Yeah, 12 plus. Yeah, Erlen? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just a little, just a semantic thing. I mean, Jesus didn't have a church, that was the only.
I mean,
that's what I didn't quite understand. I mean, who were these?
The early faithful.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, the early faithful. Six parables in that category. Then there are three categories we're lumping into one. And this category has 17 parables in it, by far the greatest number. And the general theme is disaster is right around the corner, and it may already be too late to do anything about it, and there is a great challenge in this hour. Seven, by far the greatest number of parables were parables that said the end is about here. By far, 17 out of, you see, 9, 6, and then 17, just in that one category alone. Now, there were four parables plus similes in another category called discipleship now. You and I are the disciples for this day, and Jesus has four parables. That in that category, he also has not parables in, under the way of the cross, but he has many, many similes that talk about way of the cross. So that's another category. We're not going to get to that one. And under the consummation, there were two parables plus a number of similes under there. That pretty much, plus the one parable inside here, takes care of the 40, or 39 to 40, somewhere in there. So we've looked at God's mercy for sinners here. Now we're going to do we're going to look at the parables of assurance that he gave to those within the church who are saying, Jesus, it's a good idea, but it's not working. Okay, do you want to ask it? Want to say anything?
What's consummation again? Is it the kingdom? Consummation of the kingdom?
Yeah. I said to Dan this morning at breakfast that I didn't know whether I'm happier trying to do this in two sessions or whether I'd be happier in 20. I feel very frustrated, and you must feel frustrated too, because what, you know, here I write up 17 parables under this category. Well, what are those parables? Let's do each one in detail, in specifics, nitty gritty, line by line by line by line of all 17. Let's put them on a supersized piece of a butcher paper, and let's carefully detail them right on down the line. And if we had a semester or 20 sessions, I suppose we could do that. So I don't know whether I wish we did, or I'm glad we don't. I'm not sure which. But if you're frustrated, so am I.
Jim, would it help a little to take, like, next week an 11 o'clock session and have at least one more?
Yeah, we could. Nine. Yeah. We could just see how far we go today. Mm-hmm. And so we're moving clockwise around here. We started up in the right-hand corner. We've looked at those last time. We looked at two of those last time. We left the seven of them alone. And now we're going to go to parables of assurance and the critics.
Just, excuse me.
Please.
The first category that you gave us last time, that is the circle. The
correct.
The parable of the fig tree is
correct.
The one
yes.
Parable of the gospel.
Yes. Yeah. Parables in the group called the Great Assurance. Right here. Parables of Assurance. They are mustard seed. You probably can't. Is there any point in me writing this? Mustard seed, leaven. I gave this last time, I think. Sower, patient farmer. We read these, I think. Unjust judge, and the friend who asked for help at night. Ta-da! Okay? And we'll do that one, can we? We'll do that one this morning, just because it's so fresh in our memories. The mustard seed and the leaven ones are short, and they're important. They are parallel parables. In other words, they usually go together. The mustard seed is what? Smallest of? The smallest of seeds. And the story says the mustard seed grows into a bush so great that the birds can nest in it. All right. What we have here is not a statement about growth, but what we have here is Jesus saying to the people, see the beginning and the end of the process. In other words, to people who were discouraged about how things were going with Jesus, he was saying, we start from nothing, but something great is going to come. Now, you and I from the Western world, we look at the beginning, we look at the seed, and because we've been to the university and studied genetics or whatever it's called, about how seeds have power and chromosomes and stuff inside them, we think of process, but Jews didn't think of that. They thought, boink, boink, see, little thing, bang, it works, okay? That's what Jesus is doing here. He says, from nothing comes something. From a junky little abandoned mining town in 1960, bink, bink, there's something happens, you see, quickly. That's the story of the kingdom. This is a story Jesus is telling. This parable is something Jesus is saying to people who are frankly discouraged. That this village isn't working, that this church isn't working, that this idea isn't working. Yes, it is. Look at the mustard seed. From nothing, something. The leaven is the same thing. From a little something comes a great big loaf. It's the beginning and the end of the process that's being compared. Of special importance in the parable of the mustard seed and the bush is the reference to birds coming and nesting. Birds coming and nesting, if you're Jewish, means something very specific. It harkens back to something in the Old Testament. I think it's in the book of Joel and also in Ezekiel. When you and I see see an eagle, what's that symbol? Wow, we know what that means. It means America. If we live north of the border and we see a maple leaf, it means, oh, Canada, or whatever. The Jews hear or see a picture of birds in a bush means something. It means protection from government. It means we are safe and secure, we little birds, in the tree of state. Now, it doesn't make any really difference whether that was a Roman tree or a tree from Babylon or a Hebrew tree. Some government protects us. Jesus comes along and says that the new kingdom that will give you protection is not Rome, not Babylon, not Israel even. The new kingdom that gives you protection is me. See? Follow that? Okay, I am the new eagle, he says. I'm the new maple leaf. And we don't catch that symbol unless we understand what birds in a tree mean. And we understand what birds in a tree mean by going back to the Old Testament, to Joel and Ezekiel and other places.
So he's saying he, not God.
Well, he said I'm God. I mean, he said what I'm doing here, my gospel, that is this new reality called having lunch with bad people and talking to children and to everybody else, that's the new protection. This is the kingdom in which you'll be in which you'll be protected. So those are just a couple words about mustard seed and leaven. Next is the parable of the sower, and I think Keith read this one. There will be the farmer goes out and sows seed, and some of it falls on the path, some falls in the rocks, some the weeds come up, some falls in good ground. Now, normally, what a sermon about this is all about is that Dennis has got lots of rocks in his life, and if you just get the rocks out of your life, then the seed can grow. So shape up. And Beth is full of weeds, and as soon as Beth shapes up, then the gospel will grow in you. So get your act together, and then you'll be a Christian. Okay, and that's Dan usually preaches on this text in that way, and so do I. Is that right?
Well, I saw the light.
Oh, okay, all right. And we do this because the gospel itself has Jesus allegorically interpreting this parable, saying the seed is the word. Jeremias doubts very much if Jesus said that. Whether he did or not, we won't debate at this point. I'm not able to. But what Jeremiah says is the focus of this parable is not us at all. In the introspective conscience of the West, we think we're the important part of this parable, that it's about us and the seed growing in us. Not at all. The point of the parable is at the end of the parable. And the crop was what, Keith? You read it yesterday?
30, 60, or
100-fold? 30-fold, 60-fold, 100-fold. If you're Jewish, when you hear 30, 60, 100, what it means is, holy cats, what a harvest. That's what it means. It means miracle harvest. If you hear birds in a bush, you know what it means. If you hear 30, 60, 100, it means overwhelming abundance. The point of the parable is, remember it's a parable of assurance, the point of the parable is that the harvest is so great it will just knock us over. The kingdom is secure, the church is secure, this thing is not going to fail, we are going to have a harvest like you cannot believe. 30, 60, 100. Okay? Another parable of assurance. The next parable of assurance is about the patient farmer. We read this one. The farmer sows the seed and then goes to town and falls asleep, takes a nap. What is it?
Sleeps.
Okay. The farmer puts the seed in the ground and then takes a nap and comes back in the fall, and all of a sudden there's a crop there. The point of it again is just like the parable of the sower, that the farmer does nothing. You and I do nothing. The kingdom is secure not because of anything that we manufacture or produce, or there's nothing in our hyperthyroids that make the kingdom come around. Rather, it is by the miracle and the grace of God. Okay, you sense the assurance there that comes through? Now, there are two more parables that fall into the same category, parables of assurance. One of them is the parable of the unjust judge. The other parable is the friend who asked for help at night. Because it would be normal now that the disciples would ask, why should we be so confident? Why should we be so confident that the kingdom will work? Why should we be so confident that the harvest will come in? In response to that, Jesus tells two parables to explain to them why they should be confident. The first is the parable of the unjust judge, and the next is the parable of the friend who asked for help at night. Now, the parable of the unjust judge is about a woman who is persistent. And the Bible, in fact, says she nags. Luke 18:2. Will someone have that, please? Luke 18:2. She nags the judge. Got it? Please, read it for us. Yes, 2-8.
He said, in a certain city there was a judge who neither feared God nor regarded man. And there was a widow in that city who kept coming to him and saying, vindicate me against my adversary. For a while he refused, but afterward he said to himself, though I neither fear God nor regard man, yet because this widow bothers me, I will vindicate her, or she will wear me out by her continual coming.
Wear me out.
The Lord said, hear what the unrighteous judge says. Will not God vindicate his elect who cry to him a day and night? Will he delay long over them? I tell you, he will vindicate them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, he will find faith on earth.
Will he find faith on earth?
Will he find faith?
And the question at the end is, it's not likely that that was a part of the original.
Would you say that the main idea behind that is to keep hoping, to be persistent in hope?
Yes, exactly.
Verse 1
doesn't belong.
Okay.
Verse 1 is about prayer, right?
Well, he told them a parable to the effect that they ought always to pray, and that was hard.
Right. Well, that's kind of what it's about, but that's not exactly what it's. It's not a parable about prayer. It's a parable about why they should be confident of the success of the kingdom. Let's look at each line just quickly. Verse 2. The judge doesn't respect God or doesn't respect people. The judge doesn't care at all about anybody. Very, just kind of a numb person. Now the widow. A widow could be somebody 13, as young as 13 or 14. Marriage has happened at 12 or 13, so it's not, we don't have to think 80 years of age. We can think mid-teens, early 20s. Brings her problem to the judge, not to a tribunal, which means that the problem was probably over some money matters, like an inheritance withheld from her by the family of her deceased husband, probably. Widows traditionally are the defenseless ones. That's the way they were in the Old Testament. Now, she doesn't have enough money to bribe the judge, which she normally could do, and so her only way of winning the court case is by persistence, by just irritating the guy to tears until he finally says, all right, already, get it, leave me alone. Otherwise, she just would have bribed him and taken care of it financially. Verse 4, the judge will not give an answer to the question at hand. It says, he would not venture a guess, probably because the opponent was an influential person. Verse 5, finally the judge yields because the widow simply gets in his nerves. The phrase in Greek is this widow. Okay? That is a caustic term. Okay? This widow. Got it? Okay. If the adding the this in front of it in Greek means irritation. Anyway, the central figure of the parable is the persistent woman. And so the point is that if this unjust judge hears the persistent woman, how much more will God, who is not an unjust judge, hear us? You get it? If this uncaring, unfeeling yo-yo of a judge listens to the persistent woman, how much more will the loving Father, da-da-da, take care of you and I? So we should be confident that the kingdom will come in. The parable of the friend who asked for help at night. You saw it last night. The friend comes in, knocks, and says, I need something to eat. We don't have to read it because we saw it. I'd like to comment on some of the specifics. There were no grocery stores in villages. Okay? There was no place to get food, especially if you were a late-night traveler. Denny's wasn't open, and Safeway wasn't open. There was nowhere to buy anything. The only place you could buy food was in the larger cities, not in the villages. And so one of the things that was known in the village was who baked more bread than was necessary, because the bread was always baked in the morning for the day. The women would get up before sunrise and bake the bread, and just like in any town, you know who cleans house better than anybody else. Every village knows who's the eccentric house cleaner, or who bakes four loaves of bread when in fact they only need three, or who has da-da-da, such and such. So somebody in town knows, hey, Mrs. Johnson always has more bread than she needs. Okay, so that's understood. It's kind of a background to the thing. Now the guest or the traveler comes into town. Hospitality, giving a piece of bread that you had, was not an option. In other words, it simply wasn't discussed. You just did that. I mean, even if you didn't know the person, hospitality, it meant keeping Israel alive. You couldn't. There was no Salvation Army to go to. There was no store to buy anything from, so you had to, hospitality was an essential ingredient. Everyone's in bed. Now Beth was in bed here last night, but the story really indicates that the whole family was in bed. Okay, let's talk about what archaeologists have discovered about the sleeping arrangements in houses. In the Middle East at this time, people went to bed very early, and they went to bed early because oil was expensive and they just couldn't afford to burn the lamps, and so when it got dark they got in the sack. The door shut means that the door is shut, and not only shut but that it's also bolted, and the bolts were not little locks like we have with a little key that turns in. The bolt was a post, and there were rings. There were four rings to make a door lock, and the rings were like 3 to 4 inches in diameter, and there were two on the outside of the door and two on the door itself. And so when the door was locked, what it meant was that father or mother picked up the post, round log, like that, went over, slipped it through ring one, ring two, ring three, ring four. You get the door lock? Okay? I mean, it's this long, and it's very big, and it's very noisy. Okay. Now, everybody is in the same bed, and the door is locked. It's not like you just turn a click, you know. And the response comes, the children are in bed with me. That was normal. Mom and Dad and the kids all slept together. You ever go camping, and in the middle of the night, you had to go to the bathroom, and you get up and... You ever do that? Crawl over everybody? And everybody's real pleased that you forgot, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's kind of what's going on here. And so Jesus says, even though everybody's in bed, even though the door is locked, when the knock comes on it on the door, will you get up? Well, of course you'll get up. In spite of the fact that this it really is extremely bothersome, you will most certainly get up because we share bread with each other. How much more, if you'll do that, he says, how much more will the loving Father hear you, respond to you? Why should we be confident? Because God is going to respond even more so than you would respond in that similar situation. Well, another 4 pages of notes on those two parables.
I read too that in a poorer house, all the family would be on one level and all the animals would be sleeping on a lower level, and then the door, so you'd have to crawl over sheep.
Wake up the sheep,
cows.
Too.
So it was, no small effort.
But then the story of the parables, he says, even though your friend will not get up and give you what you need because they are your friend, they will get up and give you what you need because of
importunity.
Your importunity, your unwillingness to give up.
Yes. The you won't give up thing is the same theme we hear from the woman before the judge. The woman wouldn't quit. She just bugged the guy to tears. Same thing. Knock on the door, like we saw last night. And so as the householder responded and as the judge responded, how much more will the loving Father respond? Why should we be confident that the kingdom will come? We are confident that the kingdom will come because of those sort of stories that Jesus told. So those are 6 parables of assurance. The leaven, mustard seed, sower, what's the other one? Patient farmer, who went to sleep and the crop came anyway. And then the next two that gave us reason for our confidence, and the friend who asked for help at night. Okay, those are all in that same category, and they're all addressed to people who were a little within the church, who were not sure of how things were going. The next category, where is it? Would you give me a second to find my notes here? Okay, I've got them. All right. Next category. We're going to look at in sight of disaster, it may be too late, and the challenge of the hour. 17 parables. We obviously can't do many of them. We're going to look at the first category, in sight of disaster. What this group of parables is all about. And we have here 6 parables under in sight of disaster. What these are about is that salvation is proclaimed by Jesus, but judgment is also announced. Okay? An urgent crisis is upon them. Now, picture, this is where Yoder's thing about the zealots were saying, let's kill the Romans. The Essenes were saying, let's run away. Who else was saying what?
Pharisees
were saying,
coexist.
Let's coexist and be perfect. And the
Sadducees.
The Sadducees, Herodians were saying, let's accommodate. Jesus sees all these different political parties responding to the Romans in their own way, and he says, we have a disaster on our hands. Right now, we have a disaster. We are in sight of disaster, and it may already be too late, and the challenge of the hour is immense. These parables say that an urgent crisis is upon them. Here are warnings and a call to repentance. To understand the parables, it is necessary to realize that each was spoken in a particular concrete situation. They do not propound moral precepts, Boy Scout, Girl Scout mottos. Okay? They do not give truisms, religious truisms. Rather, they shock into realization the fact that the nation is heading for its own destruction, if it's not there already. They try to shock especially the theologians and the priests and the leaders of Israel. That's mainly who they're aimed at. Above all, they are a call to repentance. Let's look at the parable of... we're going to not do children in the marketplace. It's just so convoluted. Let's look at the parable of the rich fool. Luke 12:16, please. Would someone read Luke 12:16 for us? Luke 12:16, parable of the rich fool. Please.
Then he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man brought forth plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God."
The last line. You hear it? You're starting to get ears for it, aren't you? So is he who lays up riches for himself, but is what?
Is not rich toward God.
Is not rich toward God. That's a preacher's summary that the early church added to the parable. Jeremiah says. Okay. Let's look at each of the lines. First of all, the occasion for the parable that starts before you read back in 13 to 15. The occasion of the parable is a younger brother who complains that he does not get a share of his inheritance from the older brother. And Jesus is asked for a decision in the 14th verse, but he won't give a decision. And we don't know exactly why. Maybe because he's not qualified. He doesn't know the answer. He just doesn't have a legal savvy. Or because the property is irrelevant for the life to come. That may be the reason. Verse 16. We're talking here about barns to keep the corn in until the threshing takes place. From this parable, we could conclude that the meaning of it is death comes suddenly, so don't worry too much about your bank account. Right? That's not what the... That would make it into a general maxim, a Boy Scout, Girl Scout truism. And Jeremiah says, that's not what the parable is about at all. Rather, it is this, that we are just as foolish as this farmer who is under the threat of death if we heap up possessions when the flood is just about to get us, when all hell is about to break loose. The farmer was foolish because he was about to die. We are foolish if we think possessions are at all important when... the whole world is going to collapse about us. Jesus really did. I don't know whether he saw in the occupation of Rome and in other things the physical destruction of Israel, or whether he believed that God was going to come back to end the world. There's a question about which it was. But anyway, the point of the parable of the rich fool is... concentrate on the important things. Notice, please, that it's not the time to heap up possessions because all hell is about to break loose. Now, under In Sight of Disaster, I'd like to read just a number of one-liners, Henny Youngman one-liners, that are all about how disaster is upon us. You can read the weather, but you can't see disaster coming. Luke 12. Matthew 24. Vultures do not circle over empty space. Isn't that something? Vultures don't circle. Whoa. There's dead and rotting stuff going on here.
What's the reference?
Matthew 24:28. They smell the prey. Luke 17. While you go on feasting and dancing, the terrible catastrophe will happen again to us as it did to Sodom and Gomorrah. Luke 17. The flood, the new flood. There was a first one flood, now there's a new flood at hand. Luke 12. There's fire coming, a fire and baptism metaphor is given. Luke 13, God curses the unfruitful fig tree, it dies. Matthew 7, the unfruitful fig tree is cut down. Luke 23, the fate of the dry tree is worse than the green tree, it gets burned up. Luke 21, a bird gets caught in a snare. John 12, the late night traveler stumbles on a path. on and on and on, one-liners over and over saying, it's disaster time. How do you feel about this? I mean, was Jesus, what did Jesus think that, well, what was in his mind? What disaster was at hand?
It's the same thing we were talking about last night. The powers were absolutizing themselves. And that was the disaster. That they would be not destroyed, but they would be dismantled.
Okay. It's always been curious to me that the kind of apocalyptic age, the end of the age feeling that we have, I think now,
yes,
it was very similar at that time.
Yeah.
Preachers were just rampant in that part of the world anyway, preaching the end of things, and not unlike Reformation and pre-Renaissance times either.
Yeah.
That the people saw that something had to change. And that the only way, and since everyone was continuing to go in their same direction, the only way it could change would be violently and radically.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was just sliding down the tube.
What? Do you agree with that? What was the disaster Jesus saw? More than a spiritual disaster, do you think? Or? Just the overwhelming number of parables that are about disaster. You know, he only gives 6 to assure the people. He gives 17 to say all hell's breaking loose.
We have, in the insight of disaster, children playing in the marketplace. Okay? I piped, but you wouldn't dance.
You wailed and you wouldn't mourn.
I wailed, but you wouldn't mourn. Right. That's one of them. Rich fool is another one. The servant entrusted with authority is another one. This is a real smack at the religious leaders. The parable of the talents, the parable of the doorkeeper, the parable of the fig tree. All those are a part of insight of disaster.
In seminary reading Josephus' account of the fall of Jerusalem in 70.
Yeah.
And it was a disaster so incredible. I mean, just
slaughter.
Slaughter, bodies lying 4, 5, 6 deep in the streets of Jerusalem. You know, just, you know, it was disaster beyond our comprehension. I was wondering, was Jesus... was this very specific in Jesus' mind, or was he thinking of a more end of the world? I don't know.
If you think of the prophets of the Old Testament, like Amos, Jeremiah, I mean, it's a type of end of the world they're talking about, this imminent political disasters for Israel that are coming.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possibly Jesus still in that same tradition, that's what he was talking about, and that it's misunderstood.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe so.
Yeah, we tend to look at the prophets always from the point of view of history. We understand the history after that. But if it's someone who has a feel for something happening, how they put it at the time can be interpreted any number of ways from our perspective. All they might be saying is, I have a feeling here. Something bad.
Yeah.
Something bad is coming. I mean, you can see it, you can feel it, you can taste it in the air.
If Jesus was watching the zealots, watching the political climate in Jerusalem and this constant, you know, aggravation between Rome and Israel, could he not have seen the year 70 coming?
Yes.
Do you think that perhaps he could have meant for those times, he could mean for right now, he could mean geographically, he could mean spiritually. I mean, maybe that's why the scriptures seem to be alive, because it's not just somebody talking about, you know, the situation of the United States in 1980.
Right.
He could have meant it for them just as much as he could have meant it for a country, just as much as he could have meant it for an individual. And I think even with the parables, that's what makes them so much more than what they appear to be at the surface. Because we can say, okay, let's figure it out. We decided that this parable means this. And it could very well mean that, but I don't know if we can really box it into that. But I think it could be very meaningful just for someone in their life, just reading it at a very particular time, or for a community, or for a larger community.
We have to let the parable speak to us privately, and as a congregation, as a group, as a whole church, as a nation. There's levels of meaning that we've got to just let them go. We can't say that it doesn't apply to you, or it doesn't apply to the nation, or whatever. What Jeremiah is struggling to do is to find out what it meant originally. And there he thinks, as we understand it originally, we're going to stand closer to what Jesus originally was intending.
I'm struck by, in Taylor's book, Enough is Enough, how he talks about right relationships. And it seems like it's similar to the parables are talking about right relationships, not taking care of your relationships to other people so that you're not taking from them. You give them loaves when they need loaves. There's all those kinds of assuring that there are those kinds of relationships. And that could be a relationship to the state, to other people, to individuals. I mean, it's talking about a state. I mean, you were mentioning it's not necessarily a clear-cut thing saying you must do this, but it's more talking about a way of doing things, a way of being, a way of understanding something. It's what's behind that. He's putting forth dramatizations of right relationships.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. When you mentioned Jeremiah and using the historical critical method, getting back and peeling off the layers of tradition, then does he stop there and say, this is enough for me to do? I mean, to me, a real problem would be that once you get back to the original meaning, then don't you have an interesting rabbi who was a really nice fellow saying these wonderful things, and that's it?
When Jeremias is done with his work, the Yoder starts his book by saying that Christian ethics has a whole new job to do because of what New Testament scholarship has done within the last 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. Yoder's stuff, the underpinnings of Yoder's books, of Yoder's writing, is Jeremias and C.H. Dodd and a whole crew of other people who have done biblical research. Mm-hmm. He acknowledges that at the beginning, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this is only, this is just stage one.
Yeah. Because, not in reply to it, but from picking up on what Debbie was saying, that's what bothers me, because if it's just, some interesting things based on the archaeology and all the rest, you could find the same sort of truisms in all the other world great religions, because we had to learn a lot about Buddhism, and there's so many things that just clicked to me, with Buddhism here, that, all right, here's an interesting, another expression of, religious insight at a certain time in history. But what does that say to me today? No, if we can't apply it as sort of a general maxim or an insight into the human condition. I'm just making a statement, I'm not asking a question. But it bothers me.
I think one thing is the idea that the parables are defenses of the gospel. And it's the gospel that's addressing us. And we've tended to take the particular little battles around the edge and try to turn them into the gospel, when in fact the gospel were these other actions. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Seems like these disaster parables are extremely relevant to our inner crisis.
Well, even more so, Don Conrad saying the growing gap between rich and poor.
Yeah. But then, every time there's been a crisis, in the world, when there's been the floods and the earthquakes and the plagues and all the rest of these things, people say, that's what the Bible was talking about. The Lisbon earthquake of 16, whatever, and all these things. The end of the world, William Miller in 1842.
Well, this is different, though. The Bible was talking about a selfish lifestyle leading to disaster for the nation. Is that enough? Am I?
Yes.
Right there?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's talking about an ongoing battle with the powers that be. Let's look at a parable under It May Be Too Late. I need a copy of a good one. Here's one. It may be too late. Barren fig tree, Luke 13:6. And he told this parable. A man had a fig tree planted in the vineyard, and he came seeking fruit on it, and found none. And he said to the vine dresser, "Lo, these 3 years I have come seeking fruit from this fig tree, and find none. Cut it down. Why it should it use up the ground?" And he answered him, "Let it alone, sir, this year also, till I dig about it and put on manure." When was this? 2 Sundays ago or last Sunday?
Last Sunday.
"And if it bears fruit next year, well and good, but if not, you can cut it down." Verse 6, we'll go back. And he told this parable. A man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard. Does that sound funny?
Tax is blowing its horn.
Excuse me?
Tax is blowing its horn.
Yes.
Like, tax or back? No.
You were referring to the horn honking.
Pardon me?
You were referring to the horn honking.
No.
It's weird to have a big tree in a vineyard.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't hear it. I'm sorry. No. Well, what a tree is doing growing in a vineyard. Anyway, there's no big deeper inner hidden secret meaning. But in ancient Israel, in old Israel, they put fig trees along with vines. And so they had just a whole big mess of, they just planted everything in the same spot. So the grapes would be a little lower and the tree would go up on top, and they'd use as much ground as they could. The seventh verse. "These 3 years I have come seeking fruit on this tree, and I find none. Cut it down." 3 years was the ceremonial cleansing time. In other words, if you planted a tree, you were not allowed to take any fruit from it. Leviticus had these rules. You know, Book of Leviticus had 8,000 rules about anything you could think of. One of the rules was, plant a tree, 3 years, you have to leave it alone. You take the fruit off, the first year, throw it away. Second year, throw it away. Third year, you throw the fruit away. Then, finally, the fourth year, you can start eating the fruit. And that probably was a smart farming anyway, huh? Do you think it was? I don't know why. Isn't it something about you make the tree stronger?
Or prune it, sure.
Prune it or something? Make sure the root system gets...
It doesn't bear fruit until a couple of years, and it takes a while to
establish. I don't know anything about orchards, but...
Yeah. And that would be the best fruit. I mean, you would have some fruit the first couple of years, but then...
Sort of token fruit.
All right. Well, anyway, they weren't allowed to eat it, to take any of it, the first 3 years, maybe to make it stronger. Notice it says, why should it use up the ground? Fig trees, of all the things that grew in Israel, fig trees just sucked up nutrients like crazy from the ground. So if they decided to plant one, they really had to figure out whether it was worth it or not, because it would reduce the quality of the grapes and etc. So it really did use up a lot of nutrients. And he answered, "Let it alone, sir, this year, and I'll dig around it and put manure on it." They simply didn't do that. They just did not. That was not standard operating procedures for vineyards. And so when Jesus... I mean, the audience says, "Whoa, wait a second, manure? What, you really want that thing to grow, don't you? Or this is really important," because that was it was above and beyond the call of duty and not standard operating procedures to help it grow like that. It's not, putting manure on something is not mentioned in any Old Testament passage, and it's not found anywhere else in the Jewish literature. Ordinary fig trees did not need manure. The gardener is proposing unusual methods. Let me say that there's a little interesting thing here. The 500 years before Jesus, there was a folktale that grew up that was nearly identical to this. Let me just read. A 5th century BC folktale is nearly identical to this and was no doubt around in Jesus' time. It is found in other literature. This same story is found elsewhere. But Jesus changes the ending of the folktale. In the folk tale, the tree is cut down, but in Jesus' story, it's allowed to grow. What's the point of the parable? It may be too late, but not quite too late. In other words, yes, the tree should be cut down, yes, disaster is coming, but the master, but our Lord says, one more chance you have. Just wait a little bit, a little manure. Give it one more try. Jesus takes this folktale that everybody understands, but he changes the ending. The point of the change is to say that there is still time for repentance. There is still time for a change. God has mercy. Even though the tree should be cut down, it can still be spared.
Jim?
Yeah.
I always sort of thought of that as being Israel had been barren all this point, and it should have been just cut out, but that final chance was sort of that Jesus coming, he was sort of the manure on the vineyard and having one more time. Would everybody say that that's an incorrect?
No, that's
or is that more along the lines of
Jesus is saying, I'm your last chance.
That's right.
Right. I'm your last hope. Implicit in this parable is the question, will God always be patient? And the answer is no. The tree sometime will get cut down, but not, for right now there is a second chance. You get a feeling for that, it may be too late, but you got another half an hour or another week or something. The parable of the 10 maidens, a wise lamb, we're not going to look at that one. That's long and complex. That has the same theme about getting ready for the bridegroom to come in. Parable of the closed door is similar to, well, let's look at, I just don't know. Let's look at only that one in that it may be too late category. Now let's go to the next category, the challenge of the hour. That all these essentially have the same theme. Oh yeah, okay. Fig tree, barren fig tree is one. 10 maidens. Remember they fell asleep, they were supposed to keep their lamps burning, and they fell asleep, and then the bridegroom came, the wedding party arrived, and then they were all embarrassed because they were asleep. And then they were kicked out of the party. Remember that one? 10 maidens. The closed door, which is nearly identical to the 10 maidens. And the closed door is, just because you knew me earlier in the day, it doesn't mean that you can get into this party late at night. Okay? When I shut the door and the party starts inside and you're outside, too bad for you. It's just too late. You feel it? It may be too late. You can't come to the party. I don't care if you knew me earlier or not. That's what the closed door is about. And the Great Supper. The Great Supper is a judgment parable also. So those four are a part of it may be too late. the challenge of the hour. Because disaster is upon us, because it may be already too late, there is a great challenge that's upon us. And the challenge calls for resolute action and for some decisive things on our part. And that's what we've got in the parable of the debtor and in the parable of the unjust steward, the parable of the rich fool and Lazarus, and a number more. But first of all, we're going to look at the parable of the debtor, Matthew 25. Excuse me. Let's look at Luke 12:58. It's better in 12:58. Luke 12:58. The parable of the debtor. As you go with your accuser before the judge, make an effort to settle with him on the way, lest he drag you to the judge, and the judge hand you over to the officer, and the officer put you in prison. I tell you, you will never get out of jail until you have paid the last copper, until you've paid the last penny. Now let's just make sure we've got this is reported in two different places, and it's reported in Matthew and in Luke. Let's look at it a little slowly. As you go with your accuser before the magistrate, in other words, somebody has a lawsuit against you. Follow that? And they're mad at you for doing something. You did something wrong, or they think you did, and they've filed suit, and the lawyers are all ready, and you get off work, and you go down to the courthouse. As you're driving down to the courthouse, and you end up in the same taxi cab with each other, no, you're driving down to the courthouse, and you meet your accuser on the front steps of the courthouse. Settle it right there. Don't go inside. What's Jesus doing? Giving us a maxim? like don't go to court? What's this for? This is not telling us courts aren't fun, okay? This is something else. It's an announcement about a bigger thing than that. You picture the scene that Jesus is describing? Say yes or no.
Yes,
you
or
picture
no.
It? Yes and no, Charles says. Smart aleck. What Jesus is doing here is saying, you are just like someone standing before a judge, and you are the defendant. Someone else has a case against you. But you're on your way to the courthouse. You may be arrested any moment because they might find you guilty. Suddenly, you meet your opponent on the front steps of the courthouse. Clear up the matter now, outside the courthouse, not inside. Admit you did. Admit you were wrong. Ask your opponent for forgiveness and for patience. And if you don't do that, the consequences are going to be terrible. Admit you made a mistake and shape up. The challenge of the hour is to say, yes, I have failed. Yes, I am guilty. Yes, when I go inside the courthouse, you've got me cold. Okay. The challenge is to repent. Now, it says the last copper. That's a tiny, tiny bit of money. Another detail of the thing. It says here that in the parable, the implication is that imprisonment was because of debt. Pay the last penny. Why would you be being taken to jail? Because you owed money. In Charles Dickens' day, you could be thrown in jail if you had a debt. In Israel, you could not be thrown in jail if you had a debt. It was you just couldn't be. And so, like putting manure on the trees, people are saying, well, that's not normal. And so Jesus has them listening extra well when he talks about doing things that are unconventional. You could not get thrown in jail for having a debt. Why is Jesus talking about that? He's saying that let me check my notes. What's he doing that for? Jesus is saying this to impress on his audience that this is a very severe penalty, that the judgment is very strong, and that the judgment is coming. Follow that? What I want to do is look at the parable of the debtor as it's found in two different locations, two different situations. And the point of this is to show the two different ways in which the same parable is used. This parable of the debtor is found in Matthew and it's found in Luke. We've looked at it in Luke 12, starting at 57, but it's also found in Matthew 25. Let's go to Matthew 25. Where is it? Thank you. That's what it is. Matthew 5:25 and in Luke 12. Now, please notice the setting in Matthew. What's just happened in Matthew? Sermon on the Mount. Okay? The Beatitudes have just been given. So after the Beatitudes have been given, then Jesus says, make friends quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. Truly I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. That's not the setting that it's given within the setting behind it in Luke. They're two different occasions. Let's try to quickly see the difference. The details of the parable are the same, but the setting is different. In the Matthew account, it's the first prohibition given after the Sermon on the Mount. It says, be reconciled or else your worship will be a sham. If the trouble has gone to legal lengths, go to any effort to clear it up. Give way. Take the first step. What we have in Matthew is direction for living the Christian life. In other words, what we have in Matthew is essentially, there is no denying that the motive behind the directions, what we have in Matthew is a way in which you and I are supposed to live the Christian life. What we have in Luke, rather, is something completely different. We have it as a sign of crisis and of the last times. Jeremias believes that the way it's reported to us in Matthew is altered by the early church. This becomes kind of a preaching thing here in Matthew, when in Luke it is more original, that is, it's an announcement of the judgment that is upon us, and the time now for, in the challenge of the hour, to respond appropriately. Well, we've got another 35 parables to go through, but...
Can you list other parables there?
Yeah. Under challenge of the hour, in addition to the debtor, we have the unjust steward, we have rich fool and Lazarus, guest without a wedding garment, that's a fun one. Two houses, sand and rock, remember? Tower builder, and return of unclean spirit. We read that one Wednesday, remember that? If the house gets empty, demons worse than the first will come in. Those are the ones that are under challenge of the hour. Then there are a number of others under discipleship now. There are four of them there. Should I just read those to you, what they are? Mm-hmm. Under discipleship now, we have treasure in the field. Parallel to that is the pearl. Those are similar parables. Treasure in the field and pearl, good Samaritan, last judgment, unmerciful servant. All those are part of discipleship now. Okay. Well, I'm done. Excuse me? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This speaks in a way to what Elizabeth said on Monday and what Erling said just a minute ago. This is a very short. See how short it is, but I'm going to read it.
Well, Steve.
Thank you. In our attempt to recover the original significance of parables, one thing above all becomes evident. All Jesus' parables compel his hearers to define their attitude toward his person and his mission, for they are all full of the secret of the kingdom of God, that is to say, the certainty that the messianic age is dawning. The hour of fulfillment has come. That is the keynote of them all. It is here right now. Mm-hmm. The strong man is disarmed. The powers of evil have to yield. The physician has come to the sick. Lepers are cleansed. Heavy burden of guilt is removed. The lost sheep are brought home. Door of the Father's house is opened. Poor and beggars are summoned to the banquet. Master, whose kindness is undeserved, pays wages in full. A great joy fills all hearts. God's acceptable year, the Jubilee, has come. For there has appeared the one whose veiled majesty shines through every word and every parable, the Savior.
Okay.
Jeremias is not just some sort of dusty, crusty scholar who doesn't love Jesus. And I think those kind of themes, I think when I read Yoder and then read that stuff, I think John Howard read this. Do you think he did? I think so.
When was it published?
This was the first came out in 66.
Yeah. And Yoder came out in 72.
Yeah.
Hey,
okay.
Jim,
yeah.
I can understand that Jeremias is saying that the early church was the one who added and tacked on these allegorical interpretations. But I have a hard time accepting Jeremias saying that his way of interpreting them is right, as opposed to the early church. I mean, Jeremias has to go through 2,000 years, whereas the early church was there. You know, they were, these people conceivably were with Jesus and knew what he was talking about.
What makes him think he's so smart?
Right, I have a hard time swallowing that.
Well, that's good, I think that's appropriate.
But didn't you say yesterday that in those times people thought nothing of changing stories for their own use?
Yeah, right.
Was it?
Yeah. Yes.
Putting words into it.
And I can understand that, but I can't just totally reject those allegorical interpretations and forget them. And, you know, maybe, and what you said at the very beginning of the hour was that you're not asking us to.
Something that might help, that is like, Stendhal says, let's go right to Paul, not through Luther, and maybe Jeremy is the same, let's go right to the parables and not go through the early church. And then base our interpretation and how it applies to us from exactly what Jesus said, just as that's what they were doing. They were basing their interpretation on what Jesus had actually said. In other words, they were applying it to their time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think you necessarily... Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I just... Did I make it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yet it's all scripture.
Yeah, but related to that, I think what he's saying is that even if the early church did give allegorical interpretations of the parables, by them being closer, they at least understood the parables as they were given better than we do. So they're making an allegorical interpretation out of something that they already understand. They're simply expanding it.
Yeah.
And I think what Jeremias is saying, we don't understand the parables, we only understand the allegories.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Let's get back behind the allegory. Yeah. And then there's the obvious problem. If Matthew, Mark, and Luke all have the same parable, but they're all different. I mean, we got a problem. Either he told the same thing three times and forgot the way he told it, or he told it once and somebody moved it around.
Do fundamentalists or literalists say that then that means Jesus did tell the story three times? Because it would have to be exact.
I don't know what the hell they do.
I keep threatening to give a lecture on inerrancy, but nobody seems to want to hear it. But anyway, you don't want to hear it.
You're probably wrong.
No, they worked out, it's called the Princeton School. There were some prune-eating, green visored scholars, Warfield and Hodge at Princeton in the 70s and the 80s. And they came up with the doctrine of what they call the autographa, or the original editions. That in the original editions of the scriptures, there were no errors, there were no contradictions, there were no paradoxes. They were all clear because, God is truth, God revealed himself in the Bible, therefore the Bible is truth, or God is absolute truth.
Yeah.
And therefore the original things were pure and perfect. And what's happened is that other people have come along, mistranslations, miscopying, clerks goofed up, some people
were... But there is somewhere the perfect one?
There was at one time the perfect first edition.
Gone now?
It's gone.
If God was so good at giving the perfect, why didn't he protect it?
They would answer that. Show me, they said, well, God could, since God can do all things, God did it.
That's also a good argument for original sin, how it perverts the gospel.
Yeah, well,
by writing things wrong, that's sin coming in.
Yeah.
Right.
They say God couldn't allow sin to enter in the writing of the words.
Right, but the transmission of it is a different story.
Yeah, what it is, it's a paper pulp. It's the Bible becomes a paper pulp.
Okay.